תגוסוק אינונה ברושותת אדוק קושו ניגים יערית אינונה ישבית קימנה פת ביאר פוצי גרים נקונק נניה
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the Alts, and we are in the middle of Baffin Bay. You might be able to hear the engine in the background. I'm actually sitting on the back of the boat next to my auxiliary fuel tank, trying to get out of the wind. It's too loud inside of the boat to do this radio show. The engine, I have an old Perkins 4108 engine, and it gets up and running, but it's loud, to say the least. So yeah, we're about 200 miles from land in any direction. We're sort of out in the middle of Baffin Bay. Baffin Bay is, you know, it's sort of funny what people call a bay. You know, you got Baffin Bay, you got the Bay of Fundy, you got Chesapeake Bay, San Francisco Bay, and they're all different sizes. And, you know, they can label something a bay, and a bay could be something that's only, you know, several miles across. And they could also call something else a bay, which is hundreds and hundreds of miles across. And that is the case of Baffin Bay. Baffin Bay should probably be called Baffin Sea. Baffin Bay is part of the Arctic Ocean. And I guess at its widest, it's 400 or 500 miles wide, and it's probably maybe 700 miles north to south. So it's a pretty big region. The reason we're out here in the middle of Baffin Bay, as opposed to staying near Greenland, the coast of Greenland, is because we wanted to do a microplastic survey in a small gyre that exists in Baffin Bay. And, you know, we did some microplastics trawls last year also. Found a little bit of styrofoam in our trawls. You know, you don't expect to find huge amounts of plastic. This is not an accumulation zone to the same extent that you would find in the Atlantic garbage patch or the Pacific garbage patch. And, you know, a good part of what we're doing is looking at or trying to help scientists at Sea Education Association and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. We're trying to get them samples of these plastics. They're looking at what bacterias are attached to these plastics. They're finding bacteria on microplastics in the ocean, and they don't really know what's going on with it. Is this bacteria hitchhiking on this plastics? Could it sort of be moved around in this manner? Are they bad bacterias like Vibrio? Are the bacterias eating the plastic? There has been some signs, potentially, that the bacteria might be actually eating the plastic. Although the pitting that is occurring on the plastic is so minimal, it's like trying to drain a bucket one drop at a time while somebody is standing behind you with a fire hose, you know, filling it back up again. So, you know, it's just, there's so much plastic trash, it just keeps winding up out in the ocean. So anyways, last I talked to you guys, we were in Upernavik, tied off to a gnarly seawall. We ended up getting stuck in Upernavik. You know, we showed up in Upernavik thinking we were going to be there for one day and then head out to sea. And we were a good 10 days, 2 weeks or something like that ahead of schedule, which is nice, as we have a really big project north of here. It's going to take like a month. It's going to be absolutely arduous. But we show up. We need to get fuel. It costs about $500. For me to get fuel. I carry about 150 gallons on this boat. I got 80 gallons in a tank that's in the keel, and I bolted a 50-gallon tank to the back of my boat. It looks like a big square. I got it from some farm and feed place. You know, I looked at buying like a proper marine grade tank or whatever, you know, and they wanted like $1,000 for a marine tank. So I found a steel tank that had been powder coated, and it was like $200. So I just bought it from a farm and feed place and bolted it to the back of my boat. And then I carry about 20 gallons in jerry jugs. From Upernavik North, there are no more seawalls. So, you know, one of the nice things about a seawall is that typically you can get fuel. So in like Sisimiut, where we were earlier, where I was at the boatyard, they actually have a fuel dock. Although the fuel dock is about half the size of my boat. It's probably about a 20-foot fuel dock. That doesn't stop 60-foot fishing boats from tying off to it. I mean, I've seen really big boats tie off to that little thing, and of course we tied off to it, and we had a lot of boats sticking out either side, but maybe it's a 30-foot fuel dock. I don't know, 20 to 30 feet. It's definitely smaller than my boat was. But Upernavik, you go over and you order the fuel truck to come. So this big truck comes over and lowers a hose down to your boat, and you fill your boat up. And yeah, it's sort of a novel scenario to have a fuel truck come over. Outside of Greenland, it's only happened to me one other time, and that was in West Ireland when I was sailing single-handed up the west coast of Ireland back in 2008. Fuel is expensive, as you can imagine, but it's not nearly as bad as what it could be. That Denmark subsidizes, you know, Greenland is part of Denmark, and there's about $3 to $4 billion of subsidies every year coming into Greenland, and there's only 56,000 people. So basically, it breaks down to $50,000 per person per year in subsidies. So it's pretty big. And I don't know how many countries would do it besides Denmark. Scandinavia is really, really good to their people, and Denmark is exceptional. So it's no surprise that Denmark goes so far out of their way help the people of Greenland. But, you know, Denmark also has a very small population. I think they only got about 6 million people or something like that anyways. So, north of Upernavik, there are no more fuel docks. So if you want to get fuel, you got to use jerry jugs. So we fueled up, and we got food, and we were waiting on $5,000 was supposed to come in July 1st from one of our partners. And so we fill up everything, and we only have $300 left in the bank when that's over with. This, as I've mentioned, is a shoestring expedition, and I say that in all honesty. I mean, there's no joking. This is an absolute shoestring. So we fill up everything. We're supposed to get this money, and on July 1st, instead of getting the money wire transferred into our bank account, we get an email saying, oh, well, I'm sorry for the inconvenience, but you're not going to be able to get that money until August 25th. And it's like, you gotta be kidding me. You know, I mean, it's not like we're in the Chesapeake Bay, you know. We're tied off to a gnarly seawall, you know, at like 72 north up in the Arctic, you know, desperately relying on the funding that you said you were gonna bring our direction. So, getting mad about it wasn't really going to do anything. It was sort of out of their hands. It was just they gave us the wrong date. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. So I had to go through the painful process of trying to borrow money from people and making phone calls and calling friends and family. And I really hate doing that. You know, I've been doing one major international sailing expedition every single year since 2008, and I've never had to call anybody in the middle of an expedition saying that basically I'm almost broke and I'm tied off to a dock and I need funding or else I can't continue on. And it, of course, you know, this wasn't part of the plan, but you know, Murphy's Law, I guess, I don't know. But it's one of the difficulties of doing what we're doing is you have to rely on other people. And sometimes people do what they say they're going to do, and sometimes people don't. And if somebody doesn't do what they say they're going to do, it could put you in a really bad situation. So we ended up spending like 4 or 5 days tied off to that seawall in Upernavik, because it took me a while to drum up the $5,000 that we were missing out of our account. But eventually I was able to pull it together. Upernavik is a pretty... I mean, it's a pretty bad, I hate to call it a bad harbor, you know, but the reality of Upernavik is the harbor is exposed to northerly winds, especially northwesterly winds, and it blows ice into the harbor. And a swell comes into the harbor. So when you get these northerly winds, you get a swell coming in, and you could be rising and falling from the seawall, you know, 3-4 feet. And trying, you know, then the waves are trying to bounce you off the seawall. And then it also brings icebergs in with it. So there's all sorts of icebergs in the harbor. You're just hoping that one doesn't come alongside and try to run you down while you're tied off. In Greenland, it's rare not to have to move your boat for another boat off a seawall. So we had been there a couple days, and I hate being attached to that seawall because it's just, you know, I got four big round fenders, Greenland-style fenders, you know. A normal fender isn't going to do you much good. The sort of tube sort of shaped fenders, the ones you get at West Marine or wherever you get them. But you want the big balls, the big giant orange balls here in Greenland. You want something that's really going to give you some distance between you and whatever gnarly thing you're tied off to. So a big giant red boat comes in. I don't know how much it weighed, or, you know, maybe it's a 70, 80 foot power boat. It weighed, I don't know, 50 tons or something like that, 70 tons. And it's sort of their police rescue boat. So they yelled over, hey, you know, in broken English, you know, can you move your boat so we can tie off to the seawall, and so you can, then you can tie off to us. Of course, I was absolutely ecstatic to do that, because what that means is that they can tie their big giant boat off to the seawall, and I can tie off to them. And that way, it's kind of like being tied off to a floating dock, first off. You don't have to worry about this 10-foot tie difference and adjusting lines and all the rest. And also, they're going to be the one bouncing off the wall. Not me. I'll just bounce off their boat. And, you know, if you adjust your lines properly, you don't really... You can keep about a foot of distance between your fenders and their boat for the most part. It's just about how you tie off your lines and how you, you know, how many spring lines you put out. And you know, there's techniques to all this stuff. We're going to push out in the Baffin Bay. And you know, it's like a 500-mile offshore run. And so it's a decent length. And you know, you really want everybody to be well rested before you make this sort of a trip. You know, we try to go to bed early that night, and you know, night is a relative term because it doesn't actually get dark at night in the Arctic. You get 24-hour daylight. But anyways, you know, try to go to bed and try to be responsible and all this sort of stuff. And in the middle of the night, or maybe like 1 in the morning or something like that, 1:30 in the morning, I hear something knocking off the side of my boat. And, you know, it's not uncommon for a chunk of ice to come in knocking off the side of your boat. I go out there thinking, you know, all right, I'll just push this thing away. Maybe it's the size of a refrigerator or a vending machine or something. It was huge. It was a massive piece of ice, many, many times bigger than the boat, many, many times heavier than the boat. And it had this lip, underwater lip. She called it a ledge. It was like an underwater ledge. It was a really oddly shaped berg. And this ledge protruded out maybe 20 feet out from the berg underwater. And that ledge was right underneath of our boat. And so it was actually hitting our keel. So we had an iceberg, giant iceberg, hitting the side of my boat with this giant ledge completely underneath my boat, which means that if that iceberg would have chose that moment to roll, it would have picked my boat up in the process. Now, I am tied off to this other boat. I don't know how it would have ended for me in that scenario, but that's a scenario you really don't want to be in. So I woke up the crew, and everybody came running out in their socks, and Alexander actually was barefoot. And we started, you know, grabbing poles and pushing this thing off. And at first, you feel like you're making no headway at all because it's just so heavy. And you're pushing, and the thing's just a few feet away, and you're pushing, and you're pushing, and there's swell, too. So the iceberg is being lifted with the swell, and it's like being kind of thrown at your boat. And, you know, you're trying not to break your poles because it's so heavy. But after a few minutes of constant pressure, we slowly started to get the thing to start drifting away. And it did. It drifted about a boat length away, and it ran aground, and that's where it sat. But I wasn't sure if it was running aground or not. And there was another berg creeping up right behind us. And you know, to hit, if our stern gets hit by one of these big guys, I got a wind vane on the back of my stern, and the wind vane rudder is made of fiberglass, and they would just get crushed. So I was quite concerned about this other berg coming down right towards our stern, and then this other monster that was right next to us earlier. So I didn't get much sleep that night. I started maybe around 3:30 in the morning. You know, every 20 minutes I was checking the icebergs. Around 3:30 in the morning, I finally started getting some rest, and I hear this crack and this crazy noise, and it's the iceberg breaking apart. And I come flying up out on deck just in time to see a big chunk of the iceberg, maybe about the size of an SUV, flying through the water. I mean, just careening through the water. Luckily, it went right behind our boat. Somehow, it got a lot of momentum when the iceberg broke apart. This chunk, maybe it fell in the water. I don't know. I've never seen a piece of ice move this fast. I mean, it was probably moving at 5 knots. I don't know. It was moving way too fast. But, you know, it's like a battering ram. Had that hit my boat, I'd have been in serious trouble because I didn't have any give. I had a giant steel boat on one side of me, and had it hit the other side, it would have been trouble. And there's nothing I'd have been able to do about it. But luckily for me and for the rest of the crew, this iceberg went very quickly flying by our stern, maybe only, 10 feet or so behind us. And then we were surrounded by ice, and we spent, they had like 100 pieces of ice around us. And we were bouncing up and down in the ice, and it sounded like our boat was like a kettle drum making all this noise, and hundreds of little pieces of ice, and I couldn't go back to bed. I mean, it sounded like we were bouncing around in a glass of ice water or something, so I tried pushing away as much as I could, but the jingle jangle of ice bouncing off the hull kept me awake for most of the night. And then we pushed out in the Baffin Bay the next day. Anyways, we had to cut to a commercial break. I'll be right back.
I'm standing on the ancient battlements of Castel de Belver, on a high hilltop, overlooking the magnificent city of Palma de Mallorca, vibrant capital of the Balearics, an island group in the Mediterranean Sea, which washes the shores of Morocco, Spain, France, Italy, Croatia, Greece, and many other great seafaring nations. Arrayed before me, along Palma's waterfront and onward to the town of Arenal, are tens of thousands of boats. There are juggernauts stacked with containers, cruise ships packed with tourists, ferries, freighters, mega yachts, motorboats, super yachts, sailboats, dinghies, dories, kayaks, sculls, and skiffs. Plus, of course, the ubiquitous yacht, the traditional double-ended fishing boat of these islands. Boats are this city's business: building, maintaining, repairing, refitting, and of course, selling them. And Palma has become, has perhaps always been, a world-renowned centre of excellence for sailing and for naval craftsmanship. So there's really no better place in the world to launch Boat Radio, a station for boat owners and sailors, water sports enthusiasts, armchair adventurers, and ocean lovers everywhere. Each week, there'll be programmes from the Arctic Circle, the Bahamas, Florida, Missouri, Australia, the United Kingdom, Italy, Croatia, Mallorca, and a dozen other places, as well as from the cockpits and wheelhouses of boats.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures.
Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, boat builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea.
We'll hear compelling tales and inspiring stories from often ordinary people who've done extraordinary things.
We did find an iceberg, but there is no such thing as smooth sailing when you're going north or when you're sailing as much as Ben and I do.
We'll be joined by many of the most prominent names from the fields of sailing, exploration, and endurance sports.
Mark getting a nice puff of breeze on Taylor Canfield, leading Ian Williams. He's in the black boat, jiving now.
We'll delve into the glamorous world of the super yacht.
Summer comes around, we're ready to go, and all the boats start arriving back from the Caribbean, and we all get together third week of June.
But we'll also learn how to live off-grid, aboard a more modest vessel.
I'm one of those lucky guys that didn't have to try and convince his wife to go on their sea dreams. I was thrilled with the idea of living on the boat.
We'll attend classic regattas at some of the most picturesque sailing locations on Earth.
I'm standing in the Fort Adams State Park in Rhode Island, looking back across the water to the city of Newport, sparkling in the early morning sunshine.
And we'll hear from scientists in some of the most forbidding environments.
Welcome to Ocean Research Project. My name is Matt Rutherford, and I am here in Sisimiut, Greenland.
There'll be recommended routes, anchorages, and marinas. There'll be practical tips, medical advice, accurate weather forecasts, and, in addition, an indelible streak of marine conservation. And we'll hear from you, I hope, listening at home or at work, perhaps afloat somewhere. So, welcome to Boat Radio. We're glad you can join us in promoting and celebrating the wonderful world of boats.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. I am currently sitting on the back of my boat, trying to get away from the engine noise. You can probably hear the engine in the background. Trying to duck the wind as we're motor sailing right now. It's a nice day. I mean, all in all, I wouldn't say necessarily blue skies, but half the sky is blue, and there's some fog banks, you know, out in the distance. I can see some fog behind us, and I can see some icebergs out there. You know, we're in the middle of Baffin Bay. You know, we're 200 miles from land in any direction, so there's not quite as much ice in this part. And when ice does get out here, typically it's only the big bergs. I say that, you know, a couple of days ago, we were in the fog in Baffin Bay, you know, and a piece of ice about the size of a vending machine popped up out of the fog right in front of the boat, in really thick fog, and I had to very quickly maneuver so we didn't ram the thing. So there is still some small chunks out here, but it's not as bad as when you're near coastal. I don't know what the temperature is. I think I'm at about 74 north, or maybe 74 and a half north. We're heading up to about 77 north before we actually drop an anchor again in the town of Connach. And that's where this big survey is going to be conducted in that region. And there's also, you can get fuel in Connach. Connach is the largest town to the north. Connach, it's also known as Thule, used to be south, maybe about 100 miles south of where it is today. The U.S., we have an air base, or an army base, or I don't know, some military base. I guess it's probably shared by all the different forces. But it is in Greenland, in northern Greenland. We had this military base. I think we set it up around the time of World War II. And when World War II ended, we decided to keep the base. I mean, we have bases all over the world, so it's probably not a big surprise that we have one in northern Greenland. But we basically kicked out the population of Connach. I gotta stand up. My legs are falling asleep. Anyways, we kicked out the population, or I should say we resettled the population, if you want to say it nicely. We forced about 1,000 people to move to this new place. We, even though I'm from the United States and our vessel is registered in the United States, I cannot enter this base. If I were to go and drop an anchor in front of the base and try to row a dinghy ashore, they would turn me around. And I have heard stories of people being interrogated who have tried to go on the base. So it's not a place, really, from what I understand at least, that you can stop and get fuel. I'm sure in an emergency it would be okay, you know, but if it's not an emergency, you can't do it. I have met a French couple last year, way north in Greenland. It was a French family. It was a mom and dad, and they had three kids and a little dog. And they had been in Antarctica before that. They like sail from Antarctica to the Arctic, and I guess back down to Antarctica and then back up to the Arctic. I mean, they were some pretty hardcore, you know, a real hardcore sailing family. But anyways, they told me that they had snuck on the base, and they had the best cheeseburger they ever had. But basically, when they're in the middle, they got into some restaurant or something. When they're in the middle of eating this cheeseburger, a bunch of MPs walk in and tell them, you know, you can't be here. What are you doing here? But I guess the MPs allowed them to finish their cheeseburger. So they just sort of got an interesting story of when they snuck onto a U.S. military base in the Arctic. So we're heading to Connach. As I said, we can get fuel. There is one other perk, although unfortunately we won't be able to indulge very much. But north of Upernavik, most of Greenland is under prohibition. You cannot get alcohol. The reason for this is that my family has been drinking alcohol for, I don't know, hundreds of generations, maybe 1,000 generations. I don't know. I mean, we've been drinking, you know, European stock has been drinking alcohol for a long time. And there's a lot of other cultures that have been drinking alcohol for a long time. But the Inuit, they didn't have alcohol in their culture traditionally. They didn't, you know, that just, what are they going to ferment? I mean, traditionally, they lived off of seal blubber and whale. I mean, I don't, it's not like you can make a good whiskey out of seal blubber. So Kanak is the only town north of Upernavik where you can actually buy a beer. So I think last year I went in there, they had one bottle of Jack Daniels and, like, I don't know, a few cases of beer or something like that. I mean, it's not like they got much. But anyways, we pushed out of Upernavik after spending a whole night awake fending off this giant iceberg and then being surrounded by all of its little bits that broke off of it. And it was a really strange experience. I've had a lot of ice around me on anchor before, but I've never had ice around me when I was tied off to something and with a swell, because you do rise and fall on the ice, and it's all these pieces are, you know, hundreds of pieces of ice are clanging off your boat. You know, I don't know how anybody could sleep. Believe it or not, you know, my crew slept through it for the most part. I have no idea how they could have. So we pushed down the Baffin, and we pushed out of Baffin with $300 in our account. But I think by now, I can't check the internet out here. I can't check my bank to see, but I should have money wired in it now, at least a couple thousand bucks. I don't know. I'm going to need every bit of that $5,000 to finish this expedition, because fuel is expensive, and we're going to do this 1,300-mile survey. It's going to involve a whole lot of motoring. So we get out in the Baffin. I had a good weather forecast. I used Predict Wind in conjunction with a Iridium Go. As I said in an earlier episode, the Iridium Go is kind of a finicky unit. There's a firmware update you can get, but it's still finicky, and you still have to take the battery out of it. You know, it like freezes, and it goes crazy. There is a reset button, but sometimes it goes so crazy the reset button doesn't even work. So, and you got to take the battery out and put the battery back in again. But Predict Wind has this offshore app. I started using Predict Wind when I went around the Americas. They were one of only two sponsors that I didn't ask for sponsorship for. They offered to sponsor me, which is a really rare thing. I was about 2 weeks from leaving on the trip, and I had no way of getting weather forecasts. And I was sitting in the lounge of a marina, and this would be 2011. This guy walks in, and he says, "You ever heard of Predict Wind?" And I said, "No, I've never heard of it." He said, "You should check it out." So I checked it out, and it looked cool. And a lot has changed since 2011 when it comes to satellite weather forecasting. I mean, it's just changed so much. But I called up Predict Wind, and they're a New Zealand company, but they had a phone number in, like, New York. I left a message saying, "Look, I'm going to sail around the Americas nonstop single-handed and leave it in 2 weeks. I don't have any money." I didn't even ask for sponsorship, because by that point, I was so burned out on trying to ask people for sponsorship that I just, you know, I just said, basically, to hell with it. I don't know. I just didn't want to ask anybody else for anything. You get tired of asking for sponsorship after a while. So they called me back the next day, the guy who runs it from New Zealand, and he starts telling me about this satellite communicator they got. And he says, "Oh, well, it's like $2,200, and it's really cool, and yada yada. It does email, and you can get basic weather forecasts, and it's a tracking device." And not telling me, "Yeah, man, thanks, but, you know, I can't afford that. Like, we don't have $2,000 to spend on that. I didn't even have a radar. You know, I'd have loved to have had a radar. I'd have loved to have a Valiant 40, but we just didn't have the funding." That trip around the Americas was another incredible. That was like the shoestring expedition of a lifetime, you know. I am getting tired of this, like, proletarian expedition scenario, but whatever. I guess it is what it is right now. So anyway, they end up mailing me this unit, and like 3 days before I'm going to leave and push off the dock, this thing shows up. And so they've made several variations to it since. And the latest, greatest version, you don't have to buy their satellite communicator anymore. I don't even know if they make it anymore. Now you just get a Iridium Go. And they have this offshore app, which every single year, I've been using it every year. Like I said, I must have gotten 1,000 forecasts from Predict Wind over the, you know, since 2011, because every single year I'm out in the ocean for, you know, I'm doing 3, 4, 5 month long expeditions, and then I deliver boats back and forth to the Caribbean when I'm not doing this. So on a given year, I spend about 6 months, about 180 days out in the ocean sailing offshore. So, you know, I get a lot of weather forecasts. So anyways, I use the offshore app, which is wonderful this year. Last year I had a few problems with it. They keep fixing it and making it better. You can actually get GRIB files to overlay. I'm really happy with it at this point. And the weather forecast was good. So we push out and, you know, fog. There was fog the entire time we were in Upernavik for like 4 days straight. And we came into Upernavik, there was fog. And we left Upernavik, there was fog. It's like the fog never even lifted. And we pushed out and the fog went away and the fog came back and the fog went away and the fog came back. It's just sort of typical. There's a whole lot of fog up here. And you usually see it coming out here in Baffin Bay because, you know, you're out in the open ocean and there's nothing you can do about it. You just, you know, it's just going to surround your boat. And my radar does an all right job. I really need to get my radar dome higher up. I mean, the sort of rule of thumb with radars is the higher your dome, the better off you are. So that's why you typically see sailboats have a radar up by their spreaders or, you know, at least halfway up their mast, if not, you know, further than that. I have these unstayed masts. So it's sort of a precarious situation. When you have unstayed masts, they're circular masts, and they start off like a tree trunk on the bottom, and they're like the size of a pop can on top. They're tapered. And since they bend, you know, there's no wires holding them up at all. They're bendy masts. You don't want to drill holes in it. So if you were to mount a radar on one of these masts, you would therefore have to drill at least four holes. I imagine four quarter-inch holes. To put rivets in, and you will compromise the strength of the metal to such a degree that you might break your mast in half. You know, you might be out in some good wind, and the mast bends, and it breaks right where you drilled those four holes. So I've got to, you know, mount my radar much lower. I got this like 3 foot pole that sort of extend the radar dome 3 feet higher off the top of my pilot house. I bought it right before I came out here from Defender for, I don't know, $300 or something like that. And when it showed up, I couldn't bring it with me. I had so many boxes and I had so much stuff. I was bringing like, you know, $80,000 worth of scientific equipment on an airplane, which is just a nightmare because half of the equipment, you know, it's got wires and motherboards. I mean, it looks like bombs. Like, it looks like it's a really weird stuff to be bringing on an airplane, and it's really sketchy looking. Of course, I mean, it's harmless. I mean, it's all just to do science. But TSA, I'm sure, looked at that like... And actually, my baggage was late to Greenland. I think it arrived late because it got some extra checks or something, and it showed up a day late. You know, Baffin Bay is an interesting place. Back when I sailed around the Americas, of course, I had to go up Baffin Bay, and I had a lot of fog then, and you can get fog and wind. This idea you get in the United States where you don't typically have wind when it's foggy, that doesn't exist here. I mean, you can be in 35, 40 knots of wind and still have pea soup fog. I almost hit an iceberg going around the Americas in the fog at one point. Came very close. A big iceberg, like a mountain, but I was distracted by a leaky fuel tank, actually a leaky fuel bladder, and I'll get into that story at some other time. But you do have to be careful. There's been some really weird currents out here. I haven't quite understood it. I mean, like I said, we went out into this gyre, and I'll talk more about the research here soon, but we got out into this gyre. Out in the middle is a small gyre, and a gyre is a large area with circular currents, kind of like a big vortex. Usually they're really slow-moving currents, so when you hear like the Atlantic Garbage Patch or the Pacific Garbage Patch, those are gyres. Those are these large areas of circular current, and that's why the plastic sort of congregates or, you know, collects in this area because the currents sort of push them in, you know, like a big vortex, like a black hole, sort of. Of course, there's a lot of other currents within the currents. But anyways, all of a sudden, I had to put my rudder hard over just to steer a straight line. And that's, you know, that's weird. Like, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm looking at my autopilot, the screen on my autopilot, and you can see the bars that represent the rudder angle. And I'm looking, and my rudder's at like 25 degrees, you know, over, 30 degrees over, and I'm barely keeping a straight line in the water. And it was actually kind of freaking me out. I thought there was something wrong with my steering. You know, I thought I have hydraulic steering on my boat. I'm always suspicious of hydraulic steering. When you have a normal wheel steering system on a boat, you have wires and pulleys or chain or something. You know, something might break, but you can jerry-rig it, you know, in a pinch. If you really have to, you can figure out a way to jerry-rig it. If hydraulic steering breaks, if you blow a hose, you might not be able to jerry-rig that. It's a pretty scary thought, really. And I don't have enough spare bits and bobbles to really fix it. And I hate to even think about it or talk about it. I got to knock on wood or something like that. But I'm checking my rudder post, and I'm looking, and my rudder's over, and the rudder's where it's supposed to be, but I'm still holding a straight line. I think, well, it's got to be strong current. This goes on for like 36 hours, and then all of a sudden, within 5 minutes, I've got to put the rudder over the other direction all the way to maintain a straight line. It's like I went through some convergence zone between currents, strong currents, where I had to completely throw the rudder over, and it's just crazy. And now, as I speak, just within the last couple of hours, now our rudder is steering perfectly fine. We got the rudder amidship, and we're drawing a straight line, so we're now out of the current and out of this gyre. But very surprising how strong the currents are in this region. We got to go to a commercial break, and I'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea, from boats of woven reed in Egypt to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, Director of Membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting on the back of my boat in Baffin Bay, sort of freezing my butt off here a little bit. But, it's not a bad day. We just wrapped up maybe 12 hours ago or so our microplastic survey here in Baffin Bay. That's the reason we're out in the middle of the bay. Microplastics, or marine debris, nanoplastics, there's a variety of different names for it, and it's sort of a strange thing about this research is that it's still sort of new enough that people haven't decided on exact names and terminology. So one person will call it one thing and another person will call it something else. But basically how it goes is plastic trash floats, at least some of it does. And so plastic trash winds up out in the ocean in a variety of different ways. And the larger pieces of plastic get broken down by the sort of the churning motion of the ocean. And they get broken down into smaller and smaller pieces until they're about the size of your fingernail or smaller. The vast majority of the plastic trash floating around in our ocean is these little pieces. Now, in the garbage patches, and I spent 70 days doing research in the Atlantic garbage patch in 2013, and 64 days doing research in the Pacific garbage patch in 2014. And when you get into these accumulation zones, into the heart of the gyre, you know, sort of the heart of the garbage patch, you can do a trawl. And a trawl is a device that's about 2 feet wide at the mouth. It's like a 10-foot long sort of net with a sock at the end of it. It's a real fine mesh net. So to collect all these little pieces of plastic, you can get in 2 miles, just 2 miles of trawling, you can get 1,000 pieces of this little plastic. Now, there is no island of garbage in the ocean, so that's probably one of the biggest myths. There are a lot of myths, surprisingly a lot of myths, about the open ocean and how things happen out here and what it's really like. And, you know, it's understandable to some extent. Most people are not going to wind up going out into the open ocean at any point in their life. In some ways, the open ocean is like Mars. You know, it's like the surface of Mars, you know. I mean, it's sort of this place that's distant, out of sight, out of mind. And so all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories and rumors and, you know, Bermuda Triangle. And, you know, I've sailed through the so-called Bermuda Triangle, I don't know, 20 times at least. And it doesn't exist. I hate to break it to you guys, but the Bermuda Triangle is just a myth. But anyways, there's a lot of myths related to plastic. And one of the biggest myths is this idea that there is an island of garbage in the ocean. And, you know, I thought years ago, before I started doing this research and really started looking into it, I thought the same thing. And sort of in my mind, I imagine, like, being able to pull your boat up to, like, this island and, like, get off the boat and walk around on an island of garbage. I wish there was an island of garbage in the ocean, because it would be a lot easier to clean up. I mean, you know where the trash is. You could show up with some, like, freighter-sized boat and just gather it all up, and that would be the end of the story. But it isn't. Instead, it's more like soup. It's these thousands and thousands and millions and trillions of pieces of plastic that are floating around that, you know, it's not like you can just take a net and come along and scoop it all out. Because on the surface of the ocean, just within the top couple of inches, is like an entire ecosystem. It's really surprising. You don't see it really sailing, because a lot of these things are too small. But in the Atlantic and Pacific, it was pretty common, for instance, for us to pull, when we were doing these microplastics trawls, for us to find small crabs in our net. These crabs are about the size of a quarter, or I don't know, the size of a euro or something. And, you know, you're like, what in the hell is this crab doing out here? Like, you're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, or you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Like, how does this crab survive in 16,000 feet of water? And, you know, what in the heck is it doing out there? So there's a surprisingly, you know, it's a surprisingly large amount of life. And there's all sorts of other stuff, of course, that lives near the surface. So if you were to come along and just drag a net, you would grab up, you know, it would be very damaging to the ecosystem of the ocean. You'd be basically capturing an entire layer of that ecosystem. There have been ideas. The most popular by far is this one ocean cleanup. They're going to build these, initially, 5-6 years ago, they're going to build robots that are going to clean up all the plastic trash in the ocean in 5 years. And they said 10 years. Now they're saying 30 years. They've changed the design a couple of times. Instead of robots, it's going to be some large collection system. It's a bad idea for a lot of different reasons. It's gotten a huge amount of publicity and press. I mean, I've seen it on BBC, CNN. I've seen it, you know, people must have sent me 50 emails, you know, forwarding over articles about how this thing's going to clean up all the plastic trash in the ocean. I will get into in another time. We'll dedicate an entire episode, and we'll talk to some of the experts, and we'll get into all this stuff in more detail. But the general scenario is that it's just, we need to fight the battle on land. I mean, none of the plastic trash is made in the ocean. All the plastic trash is made on land, and that's where we need to fight the battle. The plastic needs to be designed to be benign. It needs to be designed to have a benign effect on the environment. And that's going to take people investing more money into true biopolymers. Just because plastic is made from plants does not mean it's any more biodegradable necessarily. So we get out here, and you know, last year we did some trawls in Baffin Bay, over by Disco Island, and we, like I said, we found some styrofoam in those trawls. It's a really, really difficult place to do trawls. Normally, in the open ocean, when you do these microplastic trawls, you know, the Atlantic or Pacific garbage patch, normally all you get is the plastic and maybe your occasional little crab or something along these lines. In the Atlantic, you actually, you get Portuguese man of war. Luckily, you don't get that in the Pacific, but that was one of the big accidental catches that we would get regularly when we're doing these microplastic trawls were man of war. And the problem is when man of war get into your trawl, they freak out and all their little needles go all over the place. And so now you're trying to sort through microplastics and, you know, and remove them from the water and strain them through this mesh screen, and they're completely covered in man-o-war needles. Nicole, at one point, wasn't using a glove early on, didn't realize that the needles had gotten everywhere, and she ended up getting, like, these lesions across her hands. You know, it looked like burns from these man-of-war, and she touched her eye, you know, accidentally rubbed her eye, and she ended up getting man-of-war in her eye. You know, it's sort of like when you're chopping up, like, jalapeno peppers or habanero peppers, and you sort of forget about it, and you rub your eye. Or if you're a guy, you go take a piss, and then you realize, oh my God, I still had very hot stuff on my hands. But anyways, she got it in her eyeball, and her eyeball turned red, and it swelled shut. And, you know, we were like 1,000 miles from land in any direction, and that's a pretty scary thing, you know, no medical attention. But after a day or two, it did get better. Of course, if she would have got, had it been not sort of this roundabout way of getting in her eye, had it been direct, like a man of war directly stung her in her eyeball, she'd be blind. So, the nice thing is, we don't have to deal with a man of war getting you in the eyeball. But there is all sorts of other stuff that sort of makes it difficult to trawl. So last year, it was feathers and jellyfish. And it was literally like that. One trawl, we got just a huge amount of jellyfish in it. And this was just sort of bad luck. You know, the wrong place at the wrong time. We couldn't see that there were a lot of jellyfish when we started doing our microplastics trawl, when we started dragging this small net, and it just filled up. I mean, it's difficult. Like, how are you going to find a few pieces of busted up plastic that's smaller than your fingernail amongst like a 5-gallon bucket worth of jellyfish? And of course, at this point, the jellyfish being pulled through this net have all been mangled, and they don't look like jellyfish anymore. They look like a whole bunch of jam, like a whole bunch of a whole bunch of jelly. It just looks like a bunch of pink jelly. And the next trawl, it was full of feathers. I could be absolutely wrong about this, because I am not, you know, any kind of bird expert, but I wonder if the birds here in the Arctic sort of shed their feathers in the summertime. I don't know. I could be wrong. There are a lot of species that obviously fly south and, for the winter, and fly back north again, but there are other species that stay up here for the most part. And I only say this because you can find huge amounts of feathers. Like, sometimes you're sailing along and there's just like feathers all over your boat. It looks like, you know, like a shark attack or something like that. I mean, there are feathers everywhere. And you see it more near coastal than you do out in the ocean, out in Baffin Bay or whatever. But anyways, the second one was just full of feathers. So the issue we had out here in Baffin, and of course nobody has ever trawled in this gyre in Baffin Bay before, so we really didn't know what we were going to, you know, we didn't know what to expect. The issue was plankton. Now, you have two types of plankton. You got basically plankton that's made from plants, a plant-based plankton, and you have plankton made from animals. So, like krill, you know, that's a sort of a well-known. Krill are basically little tiny shrimp that I believe krill are like the most abundant thing on this planet, like per square ton, or I don't know. They're basically, you can get like a school of krill, which I don't even know if school is the right way to describe a grouping of krill. But anyways, you can get a bunch of krill together, and there's like billions of krill, you know, per square meter or something like that. So anyways, there is a lot of this krill out here in Baffin. So we're pulling this trawl along, and every time we bring it in, it's just full of this zooplankton. And again, it's really difficult because these are not major accumulation zones. This is not like one of the garbage patch regions. We don't expect to get, you know, 100 pieces or 500 pieces of plastic. You know, we only expect to get a few pieces of plastic. But to figure out where these few tiny specks of plastic are amongst a 5-gallon bucket of krill, you know, it's like a wet dream for a whale. You know, I mean, it's just, we're getting so much of it. It's just really difficult to sort through it. So it's really difficult to do microplastic trawls in the Arctic because you end up getting all sorts of, I guess, bycatch, all sorts of different stuff in your little net that you normally wouldn't get in the Atlantic or in the Pacific. Part of what we're doing is it's not just about trying to figure out how much per square kilometer. We're working with these guys at Dr. Zedler and Dr. Zedler's wife, who's also Dr. Zedler, at Sea Education Association and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and they're the ones who are looking at the DNA and the RNA of these bacteria. So if we can, you know, even if we only get a few pieces of plastic, we can put it in these little vials with this solution that preserves the bacteria, and then they can analyze the DNA of the bacteria to try to figure out what exactly it is. And again, nobody has analyzed the DNA of the bacteria in the Arctic, so it's sort of a new study, and they call it the plastosphere. The plastosphere is the microbial layer that embodies and encompasses these pieces of plastic. And so we are researching the plastosphere in the Arctic would probably be a more official way of saying it. So we got another couple of days before we get up to Connacht. The weather should be nice. It's pretty cold, but then fog will come and fog will go. But all in all, everything's working out pretty well. We should be there in a couple days. It looks like we got a gale coming at some point next week, but, you know, whatever. We'll hide behind some giant rocky outcropping or something. I don't know. We'll figure it out when we get, you know, cross that bridge when we get to it, I guess. But it's not going to get to us before we get to Connacht. Now, hopefully, Connacht isn't surrounded by ice. One of the problems is that if you show up in Connacht too early, you can't get there because the ice is so thick and so heavy that you won't actually be able to get to the town, and we're going to need fuel. By the time we get there, and it's the only place we can get fuel. So, and there's some little towns where you might be able to get like 5 or 10 gallons of diesel, but these little towns have very small supplies of fuel, especially to sell to traveling, you know, sailboats, traveling yachts. That fuel is really for the fishermen, so they don't like giving it to foreigners who are not fishermen. But in Connacht, they have a large supply of fuel, so we can show up there, we can get 150 gallons of fuel or 100 gallons of fuel. You know, it's not a big deal. So hopefully, when we show up there, it's not still wrapped up in ice. But we have to, like, you know, go walking across the ice sheet with our jerry jugs for 5 miles just to get there, which I'm not going to do because that ice could break up underneath your feet at any moment. So anyways, we'll find out when we get there. We did look at some satellite imagery, but the last satellite imagery I saw, there was still a lot of ice around there. So hopefully that has broken up in the last few days, and we'll be gone, I hope, before we get there. But anyways, check out the website, Ocean Research Project. There is a blog I did last year talking about plastics in more detail. You'd have to search through the website a little bit to find it, but it's in there. And you can see pictures from the expedition. We have one video blog up right now. We'll have another one up shortly. Hopefully by the time you guys hear this, they'll have two of them up. And you can always make a donation via PayPal. We cannot do this research without support. And we're getting close to getting our break. Hopefully this is the last year we got to do one of these crazy shoestring expeditions. I'm getting very close after 4 years of doing this without a paycheck. I haven't made a penny of salary in 4 years doing this research, but we're getting close. But anyways, thanks again for following the expedition, and I'll talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.